Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and today my interview is with Minani Thioneste, known to many of his friends as Theo. Theo was born in Rwanda in 1993 in a refugee camp. And just a warning here, we're going to be talking about the genocide in Rwanda and Burundi, and it may be triggering for some folks. Theo's parents had fled the genocide in neighboring Burundi in 1972. Most people know about the Rwandan genocide of 1994, and this year marks its 30th anniversary. But few know of the genocide in Burundi in 1972 and how it is linked to the Rwandan genocide 22 years later. The seeds for these genocides were planted by the Germans and later the Belgians, who invaded their resource-rich Central Africa in the late 1800s. The Germans started where all colonizers start. They divided the land and its indigenous people and proclaimed the Tutsis people as superior to the Hutu people, even though the Tutsis and the Hutus belonged to the same Banyarwanda nationality with the same language, the same religion, and the same clan systems. The Germans established the Tutsis, who made up 15% of the population, as the overseers, and relegated the Hutus, who made up 85% of the population, to second-class citizens and serfs on the land they once owned. With this division between people in place, the Germans, followed by the Belgians, exploited the resources of the region. And during the next 60 years, the Hutus tried to resist the oppression, but they were brutalized. And finally, in 1972, when they tried to revolt, they were systematically slaughtered by the Tutsis. Thousands of people fled into Rwanda, but between 100,000 and 300,000 people were killed. Theo's parents were among those who barely escaped.
I wasn't born in Burundi. My parents were born there and are from there, and I am from there. But in 1972, they moved to Rwanda. In 1972, there was a genocide happened in Burundi targeting Hutus.
So they didn't just move, they had to flee.
Oh, yeah, they had no choice but to flee. Yeah, that's the best way to put it. So they moved to Rwanda for 1972, and we left. I'm not exactly sure for how long, what year. But they were there for about 20 years as refugees.
Can you explain a little bit about what happened in Burundi that forced people to flee? What was the trouble?
So technically so we have this thing in Burundi, which also happened in Rwanda. We have three ethnicities, and one really is, nobody's talking about it, is the two that are fighting, always fighting. So the Twas, who are originally Burundians, also Rwandans, they're less than 1% right now. And then there's Hutus, which are majority either in Rwanda and Burundi. And then there are Tutsis. So in 1972, the Tutsis were the one in power. Those in power who have power to eliminate the other people that did not look like them. The ones in power wanted to kill the other ones.
Then you were born in Rwanda.
Yeah, I was born in Rwanda in 1993, before the genocide in Rwanda.
In a refugee camp? In a refugee camp?
I was born in the city, but my parents lived in the refugee camp. But then around that time, 20 years, you get used to the country, you'd be technically a citizen, even though you're not a citizen. Now, right. They still knew they were Burundians, they were refugees, but they were conducting business as if they were. So after, the 20 years, so this whole thing, like in Rwanda, Burundi, and Congo, Uganda too, where they have politically, there's this one group is leading. And then those who are in exile are also plotting to go back and overthrow the current government and then take over. So it's like this little cycle. So Burundi and Rwanda is like either one in Rwanda, the Tutsis leading the country, and then in Rwanda, the Hutus are leading the country, or the Hutus are leading the country in Burundi, and then the Tutsis are leading the country in Rwanda. So is always there. I have in both, especially those two countries, there's never where the one ethnicity is both running the country at the same time, either Rwanda or Burundi.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. Minani Thianoste, known to many of his friends as Theo, is describing the root causes of the genocide in Rwanda in 1993 and its links to the earlier genocide in his home country of Burundi in 1972. Theo's parents fled Burundi in 72 and found refuge in Rwanda. And a note to listeners, this interview discusses genocide and may be triggering for some. Also present in this interview is Theo's friend and fellow podcaster, Spani. Spani is a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So when my parents left in 1972, but when they trying to escape, the Tutsis were leading the country then, and then in Rwanda, the Hutus were leading the country. That went on for a long time, but during that time in Rwanda, the Tutsis were plotting to overthrow the government. So during that time, the government and at the time called rebels were fighting back and forth. So my parents, along with others, they knew like something bad is about to happen. So I was born during that time.
Yeah, you were born into it.
I was actually born at the camp, at the soldiers' camp in Kigali. Yes.
What year was that?
1993. So that's like a few months before
it starts to crest.
Yes. Either a year or a few months before everything. So my parents knew.
Your parents are terrified.
Oh, yes.
Your mother in particular, who's pregnant with you. And
yeah. On the way to the hospital and then right by the soldiers' camp. And then also in Burundi during that time, that's when they were about to elect the first Hutu president. So it was crazy. They knew, we can't stay in Rwanda, even though we are going to Burundi, because there was also this thing like, okay, if the Hutus win, we're going to kill everybody. So my parents went to Burundi, and then my mom stayed back, stayed in Burundi with us. But my dad continued, and he went to Congo. Because he knew as soon as they elect this first Hutu president in Burundi, mm-hmm. something is going to happen. Which happened, they killed him. He didn't even spend, I don't know how many months as a president.
Not really.
Yeah. And then so after that, we went to Congo. And then after that, we spent about 2-3 years in Congo. And then
In Congo, how old were you?
So in Congo, I was So we went, I was still one. And we left, I was two or three.
So it was just a series of moves to stay alive, to yes. have your family safe.
Yeah. And then in 1996 and after 1994, the genocide has happened already in Rwanda. And then the current government, which is the government now, they were like, okay, we're going to go against those that committed genocides, because the genocide, the target were Tutsi in Rwanda. So it kind of reversed. Also, during the 1993, the president, including others, at this time they were killing each other. Yeah, so after the genocide, the current government went after those that committed genocide in Rwanda. They went after them.
Yeah.
So my parents were like, it's also not safe to be here. So, and then they Even that, it was a journey. We didn't go at the same time. It was another journey, I remember. Now, one thing I never forgot is I call her my grandmother, who's the mother to my auntie, the wife of my uncle. She's the one that helped us and my sisters, or some of my siblings, to go to Tanzania. And we were in the boat, and I imagine these woody boats, and you have...
They were wooden boats with tarps on them?
No, they didn't have tarps on them, but we have... it was not... This ceiling thing we have, I don't know what it's called in Africa, but we just put it on top of us, and then because it was raining too at the same time. So we put him. So then I was three years old, and I still remember that as going through Lake Tanganyika, going to Tanzania
in the rain.
Yes,
trying to find someplace,
trying to escape. Yes, and but then because so they also had a strategy of, okay, we cannot be in the same area, we cannot move at the same time. So my dad went to Tanzania first, just like he did in Congo, because there were targets, you know, of men. Like, you know, as a man, you had to escape away. You couldn't be with your family, so you had to find a different way. But like, you know, a child with their mother. Actually, with my younger sister, she was literally born like then and there, and then they start hitting shots.
In the middle of when things started.
Like my mom is giving birth to my younger sister and start hearing shots. So
they haven't got the umbilical
cord. So she's carrying her, running, trying to escape.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
And you're...
I was three then.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those are the stories. Those are the little story we know. Our parents never tell us everything.
Full story.
Because right. I don't think they want us to
experience or live to the trauma.
Not only do they not want you to experience it, they don't want to experience it again by the telling. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yes.
Leave it be.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry you guys had to experience that as young people.
Yeah,
I mean, for me, I wasn't 10 like him, because I'm sure he has a lot of memories. With me, I don't remember much. Most of the things that I know is...
You're probably lucky you were younger.
I'm very grateful I don't remember anything. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. Menani Theonoste, known to many of his friends as Theo, is describing how his family was able to escape the horrors of the Rwandan genocide in April of 1994. Theo's fellow podcaster, Spani, joins him in this interview.
But how did you make your way? I mean, your dad was always sort of one step ahead. Tell me about him. How did he know to engineer these moves?
With this one, I don't think he did. He did engineer it, because when we went to the camp and settled in Tanzania, that's when some of those international agencies took notes, like, you know, how many people are in the camps and when did you get here, they kind of gathered all the information. And then so they decided those that left Burundi in 1972, haven't been gone for that long, they don't have anywhere to go anymore. Even if they did have anywhere to go, I don't think they have any paths or any place since 1972. So they picked those names, and then that's how we got here. Those that left Burundi in 1990. Those that flee Burundi in 1972.
Really? So those people were high priority.
Yes, those people were picked to come here. For that, few years back, there's some other countries. If my dad was home at the time they were looking for him, would have been, I believe, in Sweden. But he wasn't home, thank God. So after years later, then, because also the camp at Tanzania got to the point where they kind of got tired of keeping refugees. Because if you go back, those camps now are closed.
Right.
Yeah, so they would, okay, can you go home? You can't go home. So I think that's how, you know, it happened. Like, okay, there's nowhere these people can go. And then yeah, I think the UN and then all that international
agencies. So you were without a country. You couldn't go back to a place because it wasn't safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, with them, it's kind of different in a way. Like with us, at the time, we started claiming that it was safe. But then even though it's safe, where are you going to go? You left 1972. Somebody has taken over your land.
Yeah. It's gone.
Or like, I don't have anybody anymore.
So like you said, you're not only your land, if you don't have your land and your home, and you're sort of invisible, you become invisible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, because some people started going back to Burundi, and then even some people were picked to like, nah, I don't think I'll go to America, I'll just go back home. You know, they like, they give you the choice.
Was your dad hunted?
No, my dad was just a normal, ordinary businessman. He was not involved in other things. It's just those things that happen. When something happened, like when governments or rebels go against government or government being overthrown. So like for instance, this incident that happened, Mobutu being overthrown, a lot of people were scattered. But then I think with them it was more of, we just want to take over the government. And then with us, it's more like we're killing almost everybody. So it's from the ordinary person, majority is ordinary people.
It's just a melee. Everybody was being killed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just because they have different noses.
So when somebody asks you about your childhood, do you have fond memories of your childhood? I mean, it's like it was taken from you. You described running from gunfire while your mother's cutting the cord on your little sister when you were three. I don't know. What do you do after that?
So, like I said earlier, thank God I don't remember any of it. 99% of what I remember was in the camp, refugee camp. From 1996 to all the way to 2008, the beginning of 2008. So about, I'll say 12 years. Something like that. I mean, to now it was... That's all I knew. So it was normal to me. Playing with friends, going to the market where my dad worked, going to the farm.
These in the refugee camp?
Yeah, now we are all together. Other than, you know, some sibling, but like now, you know, parents wise and some of the siblings, we are all together now. Everything is normal now. And we're in the refugee camp where there are Burundians in there. So it was normal at the time. I didn't know how we got there, but it was normal. And but I had a little, the only difficult time I had like in the beginning of my childhood is because, like I said, I was born in Rwanda. And so then I spoke Kinyarwanda. And then Kirundi, they're kind of similar, but when you know those two languages, you know the difference. So when we got to the camp and, 99% of the refugees are Burundians and the children, everybody, and I'm speaking Kinyarwanda on them and they're just making fun of me as if I don't know how to speak Kirundi because, they, like I said, they're very similar. Like, what kind of Kirundi is that? Mm. And then and that's how I became an expert to speak Kirundi now. But those are the only difficult thing I can remember. But at the time, even now, like that was so normal to me.
Yeah, the fact that you used the word normal in the same sentence as a refugee camp.
Yeah.
That was normal.
It was normal. I didn't start questioning things like, wow, until I spent a few years here. That's when I started looking back like, wow, there's other people that are living a certain life where you think, I don't think it's fair, but it's reality.
How old were you when you started to reflect on what you'd been through?
I'll say a few years from now. So 5 years ago, I'll say, yeah, it took me a while. Yeah.
Yeah. That was like a lifetime in a way.
Yes.
When you experienced that kind of profound.
Yeah. But when I went to Burundi in 2022, and there are a lot of people living in those conditions, and seeing how life shifted is, I still don't understand it. Yeah.
What was that like to step back into that world? You must have been overwhelmed with emotion.
I was, but the weirdest thing happened. It was, I was like, wow, I'm home. Like I say, like it was normal. Like you go to certain places and like, wow, I'm home. But you also know, like, this is not fair to these people.
Yeah, but that, yeah, to say that was home.
Yeah.
To have the conjure up that feeling and you're in a refugee camp.
Yep.
That really messes with your head, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So when did you start to feel, after you came to the United States, did it feel like you were finally somewhere safe?
For me, when I think back, I think I was very naive. Because, like I said, like, you know, the life in the camp was very normal to me. But then when... I know we were coming here, but like I never had an idea of, oh, where are we going? But like I knew it was better than where I was. But because, you know, in the refugee camp, another thing is everything, like school, a lot of things is paid for. Or like your parents will have to, like, you know, school supplies. If there are some uniforms, they just have to pay for that. But like school fees were free since we were under like a UN or some organizations. But then when I came here, or when we came here, I was very naive from what I remember. Uh-huh. But I also knew this country was better than where I just came from. And I had this thing. And this thing, I'm sure a lot of people have experienced it. Like, you know, people that came here as refugees had this thing like, wow, now I can do something about my country. Mm-hmm. Which I was very naive.
Yeah.
So now in the United States, I can do something that will eventually serve my country?
That's what I thought at the moment, yeah, at the time. And then... the goal is, okay, I'll go to high school. even if like after high school, you work, even though you're not making a lot of money, is way more than where you just came from. So, you know, you can literally send a child to school for a whole year, just a few dollars. Yeah. And then college, and like, oh, I want to, you know, political science. I want to do international this, international that. And then life hits you.
Well, yeah, life is, what is it? John Lennon said, life is what happens while you're making other plans.
Yeah, so it hits you like, okay.
But your life is not over. You're 30, so you still got some years
to work on
that dream. You know?
I feel like, personally, you know, compared to, you know, the life I would have lived back home, I don't think I would have been able to accomplish what I have accomplished right now. Like, how do we conclude? Like, okay, admittedly, you are in a better place, you know, but like how you got there is one of the, I don't know how to explain it. Like, how do we conclude that? Is it those things like, you know, the end justify the means? Yeah, because a lot of people had a lot of people died for us to get here.
So that, well, I think what you're talking about, if I'm right, it's survival guilt. Why am I here, and why aren't others?
Yeah, like, should I enjoy these moments, kind of thing? You know, like, a lot of people die.
Am I entitled to be happy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what does one say to young people like Theo and Spani who have survived the unthinkable in their countries and are left in the wake of genocide, wondering, why are they alive and so many of their friends and loved ones aren't? I had no words of reassurance, because although conditions have improved in Burundi and Rwanda, the leaders of both countries are dictators like the colonists before them. Burundi's president recently called for the stoning of gay people, and Rwanda's president has ruled with an iron fist for the last 30 years since the genocide. Both presidents are continuing to rule their people like the German and Belgian colonists did 140 years ago. They're creating the very conditions that caused the genocide. Lack of democracy, free press, absence of rule of law, and the social and political exclusion. There's nothing I can say to these young men. I'll just try to be as hopeful as they are in their efforts to prevent the same atrocities from happening here. Theo and Spani, who have been friends since they met at South High School in Denver, have created a podcast they call Niyuki. In their Niyuki podcast, they invite their guests to discuss issues affecting the African community worldwide and the African immigrant community in Colorado. Theo and Spani say they want their podcast to, in their words, serve as a tool for the many voices who have been silent in our community. You can find their video podcasts on YouTube. Just look for Niyuki, N-Y-U-K-I. You can also find the audio version wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. And tune in next month as Spani describes his family's escape from the Democratic Republic of Congo.